Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
All right, I'm not sure out there who likes wine, but if you check out Jen or my stories, you'll know that we occasionally like to enjoy a glass of wine. Jen loves her rosés. I'm a fan of different types of reds. But one of the difficult things is when you're shopping or when you're going through a liquor store, perusing the aisles, how do you know what bottle of wine to trust? Do they use organic grapes? Are they using different herbicides or pesticides? Are the bottles of wines tested? And you really trust the processes that they use, that they're respecting the land. That's why we have partnered with Dry Farm Wines, because we know that they are always using organic grapes. Their bottles are tested for different herbicides and pesticides. They use regenerative agriculture just to create this honest bottle of vibrant, fresh, bright wine. So if you want to try out Dry Farm Wines, they ship it right to your door. Get the link in the show notes. It's dryfarmwines.com/optimal, and you will be able to get for your first order one extra bottle of wine for just a penny. And I promise you, you will not be disappointed. The wine is delicious. You can trust what's in it, and you'll enjoy every single last sip. So go check that link in the show notes, dryfarmwines.com/optimal. Get an extra bottle of wine for a penny, and we promise you'll love it. All right, let's dive into the episode. Exciting to listen into and super powerful, the story that Anya Fernald has. Anya is the founder and CEO of Belcampo, and she really has this incredible story of what was going on in her body, some of the things she was experiencing, and how drastically those changed when she moved to Europe and worked on regenerative farms, ate the food, and learned some of these different practices, one that she now has brought back to Belcampo in the States, where they do regenerative farming to be able to treat the land as you should, raise the animals as you should, and they make this food accessible all throughout the country through their online delivery platform, which we would definitely encourage you to check out. It makes high quality food highly accessible to everybody around the country. So listen in.
Anya, thank you so much for being here and giving us your time. We absolutely love what you do because we get to enjoy it every day almost. I swear we have Belcampo so often in this house.
Yeah, it's kind of an addiction.
The healthiest addiction.
Yeah, exactly.
The best of addictions.
So how did you really come into creating what you've created? Like, why, what drives you? What's your passion behind it?
I love food that's at the intersection of health and wellness and planetary wellness, right? Yeah. So I like to eat and cook in a way that's responsible for the environment, but also makes me feel amazing. And I got my start working in Europe in my early 20s as a cheesemaker and working in animal agriculture pretty much throughout my career. I was deeply immersed in and learned a lot about regenerative farming in my 20s, living in Italy and working on farms and eventually in basically economic development for small scale regenerative farming enterprises there. And I really loved the way my body felt eating that food. And it's a fire in me now to say, okay, to eat healthy, it's not about eating powders and pills. It's like whole foods that are produced in a way that's conscious and supports optimal human wellness. That's, you know, that's a dream for me to be able to supply that type of product.
Yeah, I love that. And I kind of want to dig into that a little more where you say that, you know, when you started eating these whole foods and real foods, you really felt it in your body. Can you tell a little bit more about some of the things that may have changed in your body when you started to make that change in your diet?
Yeah, it was very, very compelling story for me, right? Because I was a child of the 90s. I was not a very serious athlete, but a competitive rower, cross-country runner. And so I was, you know, eating for athleticism, but I was eating low fat. And I was afraid of meat. I was vegetarian and vegan on and off for 9 years. And when I moved to Europe, I reincorporated animal protein, especially cheese, into my diet because I had been interested in baking. I'd worked as a baker. I started to make buttermilk and eventually made cheeses and then eventually moved to Europe to make cheese. So obviously I'd been eating some animal protein, but nothing like what happened when I moved there and I started living in small scale farms. Mm. And I would eat, upwards of a pound of meat and cheese a day, sometimes 2 pounds. And my calorie load was way higher. I got way leaner. My energy levels normalized, but my moods improved immensely. And I had, in college, thought that I was on the border of depression, had trouble with seasonal stuff. I, went to college in Connecticut, grew up in California, and was always really struggling with the weather. But also physically, like a million little things happened where I used to have a lot of cavities. I had trouble with frequent yeast infections or UTIs as well, just kind of signs of general inflammation. I struggled with maintaining weight. I struggled with putting on muscle. I also had little kind of irksome things like, having really dry skin, having my nails flake and having a lot of like dots in my nails and then my nails actually flaking back, like the top level of your nails falling off. And I didn't use nail polish or anything. That was just like, they weren't very strong, and also like split ends. And I remember going back to the U.S. in the middle of my first year living on dairies, and I went to the dentist, and I'd had 3 cavities that I was supposed to get filled before I left, and I hadn't done it. And I was like, great, I'm going to go back and get this dealt with. And my dentist said, you don't have the cavities anymore. Like, they're gone. Well, how's that possible? And I didn't put that together until like reading Weston A. Price many years later that the shift in my diet is what happened, right? Wow. The shift in my diet. And it was amazing to me, just things like learning how to smell food. I remember distinctly the smell of my body changing too. Mm. And this is going to kind of TMI zone, but like, I remember like the smell of my sweat and my body just changed. And it was like, and I noticed it was less acrid and it was more like, it just smelled more natural. And now in retrospect, a lot of the stuff I didn't put together until much later, right? When I'm like, oh wow, all these little like perennial problems that I had disappeared. And I was really happy for the first time and consistently in a great mood. And it all kind of happened around the same time that I really radically shifted my diet. Now, there's other things that were going on, like I was no longer in college and I wasn't like a super crazy academic. So college was pretty annoying for me. So great. I was out of college. I was working. I was outside. I was getting sunlight in the morning. I was moving a lot and I loved to move. Like some other stuff was going on for me too. That was really positive. But it was really diet related because that was the most significant shift in my life in that time. And when I came back to the U.S., from the start of when I moved to make cheese to when through my professional career, ended up being 8 years start to finish. And I moved back and I jumped right back into American life and I immediately pivoted back to the old issues. And it wasn't until I really actively cleaned out my diet here in the U.S. and invested in ways to get good, clean protein that I was able to get back to myself.
Wow. So what kind of diet, like what specifically were you kind of eating? Because going from vegan vegetarian to eating on a farm, that is quite a leap. And I feel like a lot of people listening are just trying to still comprehend and put that together.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a college athlete and vegetarian sometimes, and then eating eggs and things, I was eating, cafeteria food and I was eating a lot of, like everything that people ate, processed, low fat foods like Entenmann's or Snackwell cookies. I remember eating a lot of spaghetti before races, usually with not much fat because we thought that fat was bad. Eating a lot of fruit, and never like butter. Right. Mm-hmm. A little bit of, cheese when I started to make it myself and, lots of like pasta, breads, toast and low fat cookies. Right. That was a pretty high carb, highly processed diet. When I started working in Italy, first in Wales was my first cheese making job. I would eat, I'd start working at like 4 or 5 in the morning milking and have just coffee. And then at 10 or 11 a.m., you'd stop the major shift of work for the day And I would eat, I remember distinctly in Italy, it was like about 2 pounds of fresh ricotta, which is, wow, you know, whey protein in cheese. It's a very, it's high in albumin protein. So it's made from whey, ricotta cheese. It's very light, but very high protein and lower fat. So I'd eat like a pound and a half of that with olive oil and salt on it, and a couple big slices of soppressata, which is a really fatty ham, pork-based salami, and some of the local bread.
Wow.
And I remember talking to one of my girlfriends from who is also an athlete, and she was like, you know, I remember I just read this study about dairy farmers, because I was going to work on cheese dairy. She's like, there's these dairy farmers, and they'll drink like 2 gallons of whole milk a day, and they're incredibly good health. And I was like, well, that's crazy. There's no way you could drink 2 gallons of whole milk a day and be in great health, right? And then fast forward like 3 months later, I'm eating the equivalent of like 2 gallons of whole milk a day and losing weight and feeling amazing, right? So that was the shift, right? So it's from eating from a grocery store and eating like a kind of not super aware 1998 college student to eating a very traditional farm diet.
Wow.
And then that kind of deepened. Then I got real jobs. Like, so I was working on dairies as basically an intern. And then I was hired for a proper full-time job in Sicily, in Ragusa, which is in southeastern Sicily. And there I started to eat a more diverse diet, but also lots more foraged and, you know, gathered foods, lots more meat as well. They have like a traditional local cow, and they have all these different ways of eating it. So that's like things kind of amplified. But the real base of it was like basically 80% of my calories were animal fats and proteins and olive oil. And the remainder was like seasonal vegetables and a little bit of fruit.
Well, I'm still like drooling over here thinking about the ricotta with the olive oil and the soppressata and bread, because that is like a dream meal for me.
It's so heavenly. And it's also like, here's the other thing, guys, is like you have that after we basically are fasting, you know, for the first like six or 7 hours of movement and work. But there's also just like a lot. I remember just while we're in the like sharing from my memory vault of experiences, like something that an experience that changed my life. In that time in my life, I was 21 and I went to Sardinia to visit producers of traditional sheep milk cheese. And I gotten a couple addresses and I set up an appointment with this guy way in the backlands in Sardinia. So I, you know, stayed in a little hotel, this little town, and I, you know, got up really early the next morning at like 5 a.m. in the dark and drove way up into the hills to this guy's place. And I get there and it's just late, and outside of his house, I see like all these like sheepskins with the blood on the back still, like just literally from freshly butchered sheep hanging on a clothesline outside of his house. It's like, wow, this is going to be intense. And I go there and he's making, you know, cheese over an open fire, really traditional, all the sheep he's milked himself. And he's using rennet actually from the stomachs of baby calves. So very traditional. So if you know about cheese making, like typically you get a cultured vegetable rennet, and this guy is actually making it from animals himself. So very, very traditional farm. And I watch him make cheese for a number of hours. At this point, I spoke decent Italian and sat with him and talked about the cheese making. And then like around, you know, 11, I'd been there probably 5 hours watching him work. He says like, do you want to stay for lunch? And I said, sure. And we go in his house and he literally like lights a little fire of twigs in his fireplace. And I'm like, oh God, this is going to be a long day, you know? And I'm also really stinking hungry at this time, you know? And we sit down in front of the fireplace in his little stools, and he's talking to me about his parents and the land and all these great things I love to hear, but I'm also really hungry. And then he gets this little fire going, but then within like, you know, 8 minutes, they're twigs. So they burn down to embers. He takes like these big, thick mutton sausages with blueberries in them, like with wild blueberries from the hills and oregano from the hills in them, and out of the fridge, and throws them on a little teeny like cast iron griddle over these twigs that are burning, cooks these sausages up, pours some like blueberry wine, and like gets like a handful of all, and like in 15 minutes we have this meal that blows my mind. Wow. You know, and that was another really kind of key point for me. It was just like, wow, there was just like this sensuality, this beauty. It was all from the place, and it was done. It's like the middle of his workday, but he's lighting a fire and making it the right way. And I don't think he was doing that because I was a guest. That's what he did pretty much every day, yeah. You know, and it was the beauty and the kind of elegance of that where I thought like, damn it, like in the U.S., you know, you would have, you know, had somebody, showing up at your workplace, you know, what would you have offered them? Like, oh yeah, here's the, where do you want to get takeout from today? Or yeah, here's some energy bars and a package of chips, you know, that whole culture. And it's not even about hospitality. It was like self-care, right? Where it's like, oh, you have 30 minutes. You can light a little fire and take the sausages out and cook them. And there's time for that. If you think about it in a really expansive way, there's time for this. And there's time to, in doing that, you're taking care of your health in a very, very different way.
Yeah, you're giving me some real good memories of visiting my own family. I have some family outside of Rome, and one of the first times we went and visited them, it was like all of the things had been made from the garden right in their backyard. And you could just tell it was the practices that they lived by and the things that they just did every day. And such amazing value in both the taste of the food and how simplistic the food might be, but also what it does for our bodies, which is kind of where I want to go back around to. You've mentioned a couple times regenerative farming. And I think, you know, a lot of the benefit that we get in our body from these animal products and other products we get from the land also come from the practices. So can you explain a little bit about what regenerative farming is?
Absolutely. So regenerative farming is farming that is paying attention above all things to the health of the soil. And that's about the priority that we set on the health of the soil. Conventional farming is paying the most attention and laying the greatest priority on productivity and yield. That's the contrast. Regenerative farming isn't anything new. If you were a farmer in Laos or wherever, Bolivia or, you know, Italy or wherever it might be, 100 years ago, you were regenerative. And that's not because you were like tracking carbon sequestration. It's like that your kids were going to live on that land and your grandkids and your great grandkids. So in all traditional cultures where there was a legacy farming culture, where you farmed your parents' land, regenerative farming was the norm. You were interested in, you know, think about it. It's like, are you going to get more tomatoes than anybody else out of the ground this year and then bankrupt the soil for the next two generations? No way, right? That wasn't what you were going to do as a legacy. Now, you didn't have the tools to either, right? But broadly, regenerative farming has been in place for far longer than conventional farming.
And what did you see when you went from coming back here? Did you find it? Like, what was your experience in looking for this in America?
Very small scale and mostly in the vegetable industry. Mm-hmm. So I think especially here in the West Coast, you know, you have the culture of like CSA farms and farmers market farms of really premium back to the lander farms from the 70s onwards, right? So there was definitely a regenerative ethos in many of these kind of like greater Bay Area and greater Los Angeles farms, Sonoma County, right? These kind of places. So there definitely was a small reality of that. In meat, no, I didn't see anything of that yet. Now, regenerative farming, what you're looking at is, just to be really clear, you're prioritizing soil health, which means that you're increasing soil carbon. When you increase soil carbon, you actually increase micronutrient density in the soil and create healthier products. That's the real math of it. It's not really about, I mean, it's good to feel about, you can feel the life force energy. I feel people talking about your meat has a high vibration. Like I get the woo and I hear that and I respect that. But there's actually a really cool scientific piece as well, which is that when you farm regeneratively, more carbon ends up in the soil. When there's more carbon in the soil, there's more like food for the microbiome of the soil. The microbiome of the soil needs carbon to thrive. That microbiome in turn produces plants and animals that have higher micronutrient density. You can't create micronutrients out of nothing, right? Yeah. So they have to come from somewhere, and they come from the soil. They come from rich, biodiverse soil.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my next questions is, so how does that transfer into the animals? But I think you painted it beautifully right there that if there's more nutrients in the soil, there will be more nutrients in the grass that then the cows will be eating, you know, therefore putting better and more nutrients into them.
And it's, animals are like magnificent processors, right? I mean, think about like the kind of like just what our bodies are capable of, you know, that we can thrive on times when we eat terrible food and we can thrive, you know, we can still get things done and we can still function. And when we're in terrible context for food and people can make it through starvation and still their brains still work and they can still have babies, right? So the thing about animals is it's less of a direct line. With vegetables, you actually can trace a very, very clear line where, you know, the broccoli that comes from the regenerative farm has far more micronutrients and, you know, lots better quality for you than a conventionally farmed. With animals, it's a little bit more of a mix because the animals themselves do such a good job at buffering for the environment. I think the bigger health benefits for animals on regenerative farms actually are due to the fact that they're growing more slowly. So I think that the micronutrient density in the pasture is good for their health and makes them more robust, definitely. But if I look at like the direct health benefits to you eating meat, slow growing is probably, you know, after sort of years of staring at the nutritionals and looking at the issues, I'd say slow growing is the big issue for a human consumer, mm-hmm. because slow growing equates to higher protein density per ounce of product.
So with saying that, you know, slow growing, some things I've heard some people say like, oh, well, if all of the farms were regenerative farms, we wouldn't be able to produce nearly enough food for everybody in our country. I've heard some people say that based on how we currently, you know, have this factory process of farming animals that kicks out a ton of food supply for everyone.
That is absolutely a fallacy. And the issues are, there's a lot of nested issues in that. And the part of it that's true is that there's no way we could create enough food at the current price point in the current price structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I'd also say, well, the current price structure has created a context in which we throw away something like 40% of the meat that we produce in America is thrown away.
Oh my goodness.
So awful.
Okay. So it's like we raise animals in torture. We do terrible things to the environment. You know, the communities that work in the feedlots and who live near them have all these terrible health consequences. And then we throw away 40% of that stuff. Well, okay. Congratulations. Like there's your cheap cycle, right? It's cheap in every aspect. So that's the problem with this is that, yeah, okay. If we were to price meat more rationally, you know, you don't see many like all you can eat meat rich buffets in many other countries, right? Like we're kind of the only people that have this cheap meat thing figured out. And it's because we're very comfortable externalizing costs in the US, right? We don't have much of a mandate culturally to internalize the full cost of production systems in all aspects of our world, right? Here in the US. Mm-hmm. So in light of that, our meat's artificially cheap. And so we throw away a ton of it. So yeah, like just think about it, like where you could kind of chip away at that. You could say, well, if you could produce 40% more meat just out of the gate by pricing it in a way where people are disincentivized to throw it away, you don't see like huge caviar wastage numbers in the US, right? Hmm. Things that are priced expensive don't get thrown away.
But then if things are priced expensive, can we get the access to people who need this kind of nutrients, you know, within their body instead of this stuff that they're getting at the cheap stores?
Well, then that's the other piece of the question. It's like, that's where you get into really complex territory from like a justice and access perspective.
Yeah.
You know, where I say, okay, if I was to look at how do you shift health outcomes in the US across many different vectors that are totally socioeconomically aligned, right? How do I move the needle? Meat would be the first way I would do it. Mm-hmm. And if you think about disenfranchised poor communities in the US, that, you know, hey, the CAFOs are all situated near low socioeconomic status communities, right?
Yeah.
And so the impacts, the actual environmental impacts of tetracycline in the water and all of those things, right? Terrible working conditions and slaughterhouses, like all the bad meat industry stuff is absolutely disproportionately affecting the poor.
Yeah.
Right. And then we're also saying, yeah, but we're doing it so that the poor can have meat, you know? And it's like, well, this is kind of a broken logic to me.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like, so is it worth it to have 99 cent a pound chickens? Is it worth it that you have these insane, terrible working conditions that have all these horrific health impacts on workers? Is it worth it that the very like disenfranchised, poor, typically new immigrant people who live near CAFOs and also in the Southeast African-American legacy communities that have disproportionately high incidence of low birth weight and miscarriage? Is that worth it? Is that worth your 99 cent chicken breast for that community? Right. So it's like, that's where the challenge is. And I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah.
I don't have the answer. I think that's a bigger ethical question.
Totally.
Right. Yeah. So I think this cheap meat paradox differentially, like we're so focused on meat coming in under this, like this bar on pricing, and that is justice, that everybody can get it, that we're not looking at like, well, what is justice more broadly?
Yeah. I really appreciate how you answered that question. I mean, first by saying it's a very complex issue. Yeah. That's not going to have one easy answer. But I mean, one thing I always think of is like the cost environmentally and dollar wise to get a quarter pound burger to a fast food restaurant and where all that cost is absorbed. I mean, think about if we, you know, used all of that money to produce that thing to be able to get it to market at such a cheap price for a dollar or $2 at the fast food market. There's a lot of restructuring that needs to happen so that we can still get good quality, you know, environmentally consciously produced things to market at an acceptable price for everybody. But in a country that we live in, I know we have the resources to make something like that happen. There's just a lot of things at play. So that that makes it really difficult.
Totally.
Well, it's also like, just think about it. You know, every pound of corn-fed meat is subsidized in the U.S.
Yeah.
Every box of Cheerios is subsidized in the U.S. Every box of cookies is subsidized in the U.S. Every box of cornflakes is. Bag of Fritos is subsidized. Every single one of those products is subsidized. Grass-fed finished meat, not subsidized.
Exactly.
I mean, it's also like, okay, so I just, you know, I guess I push back because I'm like, well, wait a second. Yeah. Is my meat really expensive? Yes. Is it expensive because I'm like laughing all the way to the bank? No. Trust me. Right. Yeah. My margins are slimmer than most of my competitors. Right. It costs a lot more to do things the way that I do them. And I also don't benefit from this massive amount of subsidies that flows into my competitors, right, for producing unhealthy products. And then I also, you know, don't create any of these externalized huge impacts in terms of the healthcare bills for the slaughterhouse workers, the negative health impacts and long-term outcome impacts, people who live near the CAFOs, the negative impacts on people's health of the omega 3-6 ratio of confinement beef. So it's like, I don't really feel like I need to be accountable to that because it's not quite it's so far from a level playing field.
Yeah.
You know, so when people say, hey, let's talk about elitism and price and access. And I'm like, yeah, well, let's talk about it. But let's talk about it, you know, from 30,000 feet. Because when we look at it from 30,000 feet, my prices aren't the issue.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's like a broader societal issue. And the thing that makes me so upset about this in the long term is, you know, this battle around like alternative meats, you know, and possibles and stuff. It's like, we're basically, there's a battle for the pocketbook of the country's worst off from a health outcomes perspective and a financial perspective, right?
Right.
That's what we're fighting about with Impossible Foods isn't competing for my audience. No way.
Yeah, exactly.
They're, you know, you're fighting for the McDonald's audience. And that's what makes me so sad, where I'm saying like, wow, we have this potential to have beef and livestock that could transform the environment of the U.S. for the better. And instead of kind of making it a tool for good, we've like decided that it's broken and we're going to replace it with more hyper-processed soybean products that are going to go into the mouths of the country's worst off.
Yeah. Can we talk about a little bit too of what is truly the benefit in getting something grass finished? What is even the difference? I learned only a year ago, the difference between grass-fed and grass-finished, let alone, you know, anything else that might go into it.
Yeah, and even all the things that come with that, like pasture-raised versus cage-free versus, you know, no hormones added. Like, I know there's also a lot of greenwashing that happens in the meat industry.
Absolutely. Well, I think, first question, difference with grass-fed and finished, from a human health perspective, its omega-3 to 6 ratio is the biggest difference. Our meat is a 1-to-1 omega 3-to-6 ratio. Most meat that's labeled grass fed in the grocery store is a 1-to-12 ratio, and confinement conventional meats like a 1-to-30 ratio.
Wow,
that's a big deal for health because anything sort of higher than a 1-to-4 ratio is inflammatory. So I'd say from like lock, stock, barrel, like what's the real nuts and bolts, you know, science of it? It's omega 3-to-6s. Then I'd caveat in saying, you know, if you're looking for just straight up omega-3s, like walnuts are a better source than beef, right? But if you do eat a lot of beef, you want that ratio to be in line, because if it's not, it's going to be a pretty big source of inflammation in your diet. Then the other piece of it is grass-fed beef across the board, it's lower in fat, about 30% less in fat and higher in protein. The protein differences aren't as high. It's like 10% higher in protein. So that's the real difference from a perspective of like the actual health impact. Then, you know, confinement beef is fed things like expired candy in their wrappers, plastic shavings used as a fiber additive to food. All that stuff has BPAs and other bad things in it that, you know, there's like a trace toxicity issue for sure in confinement animals. And then there's kind of the change you want to be in the world broadly, right? Which is like, do you want to be eating animals that are growing at a unnaturally fast rate, putting on a lot of muscle mass quickly, and doing it in a way that's toxic for the people who work there and potentially for you in the long term if you eat it. But what's actually really documented, it's the fats and the fat ratio. What you're looking for in labels, if you're just heading into the grocery store and you're saying, okay, what should I be buying? In your ruminants, which is your lamb and beef, I want most important grass-fed and finished. And another way you'll see that written is 100% grass-fed. And that's because people will say grass-fed, but then it might have spent 3 months on corn at the end of its life, which fattens it up and is cheaper. But that's why you have to look for 100%. Don't just take grass-fed. It has to be 100% grass-fed or grass-fed and finished. That's my number one thing for beef and lamb, 100% grass-fed. Second, I'm going to look for a label, an organic certification, USDA or CCUF or something. Third, I want an animal welfare certification, like GAP 4 or Certified Humane or Animal Welfare Association approved. So the ranking for beef and lamb, again, is 100% grass-fed or is one, organic is two, and humane is three. For non-ruminant species, monogastrics that we eat, which is chicken and pork, it's a different ranking. Chicken and pork can eat only grass and forage. It's doesn't produce great tasting meat. It's not an actually very adaptive diet for them. They're omnivores. So chicken and pork will happily eat bugs. And in a case on our farm, the pigs will actually hunt and eat snakes and things like they're carnivores too. But they do naturally gravitate and thrive on a mixed ration with grains in them. Right. So what you're looking for then is first label is pastured. And pastured means that the animal lives outdoors, which is the most natural form. Free range and cage free are really meaningless certifications. So you see, I buy a free range organic chicken. I don't care. Free range is not a meaningful certification. It means that the animal has access to the outdoors, but that doesn't mean that there can be a hoop house that's 80 feet long. And the door to the outdoors is 18 inches wide.
Yeah.
And then the outdoor area is big air quotes. It's like a little dog run outside the hoop house.
Yeah.
So pastured means that animals live outdoors. That means they grow more slowly because they're subjected to the elements, right? So pastured is my number one. Number two is organic. And again, organic animals' bodies are incredible filtration machines, right? I don't think that I'm anti-GMO and anti-glyphosate and those things, but those animals' bodies are really, really good at filtering it out. So the organic certification for me is like about being the change you want to see in the world and wanting to see fewer genetically modified crops out there, right? So that, though, from a human health perspective, I would absolutely choose pastured over organic. And the reason why is like in our chicken, I've tested the collagen in our pastured chicken is 10 times as high as the collagen in a free-range chicken. Because the animals are actually moving. So they develop connective tissue, musculature. You know, so pasture from a health perspective, so important. Our chicken also has 20% more protein per ounce. It's so amazing. You know, like you get way more bang for your buck. So pasture is number one, organic's number two, and again, humane is number three. And that's also like in grass-fed and finished or in pasture, which are kind of the analogous claims or certifications between the, you know, beef, lamb, and pork, chicken. It really, that kind of encompasses humane, you know, because if the animals are truly pastured, that's a much more humane way to raise them than even like a humane certified free range operation from my perspective, based on what I've seen visiting, you know, dozens of livestock farms, right?
Yeah.
Animals indoors is cruel fundamentally, and also doesn't produce the best in terms of health outcomes for you as a human eating their meat.
So when we talk about accessing this other places as well, because, you know, we're spoiled, we're in LA, and we get to not only experience your restaurant that you have here, which thank you, but
absolutely,
and we can just drop by and pick up meats like as we need to, you know, anytime. but getting this access other places as well, like what has been your driver in providing this access other than just here in California?
I would like to create a national meat brand that stands for quality, that offers levels of traceability, safety, and assurance to a consumer, a meat consumer, that's unprecedented. So that's really my goal, is I would like to create an option for consumers. Because, you know, you go into most grocery stores, apart from like a couple, and you don't have good choices there.
Yeah,
you just don't have good choices. So I'd like to create a brand that is more widely available than it is now, that actually offers consumers a real choice for a meat that they can feel great about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd say that you're well on your way already. Yeah. Because
exactly.
Speaking to what you were just talking about, when we go to Minnesota, where I grew up, I mean, just even an hour outside of Minneapolis, you would really kind of have to search and dig to find different meats that hit a lot of those criteria that you just named out, the 100% grass-fed and finished beef, pasture-raised products,
organic.
Like pork and or organic in general, unless you know a farmer that has those specific practices and you can like buy a quarter of cattle off of them or something like that. But not everybody just has that immediate access in one of their local grocers. But when we were in Minnesota this most recent time, we ordered up a big box of Belcampo meats, shipped right to our door, and it was incredible just being able to have that shipped nationally right to our doorstep, products like you said that are quality that we can trust. So really appreciate that you're already, you know, forging into that space.
Yeah, and COVID opened that up for us, you know. That was thanks to COVID that we were able to launch e-commerce.
Yeah.
And now it's been growing huge for us, and I really think it's the future. I mean, it's such a great way to connect with our consumer. People can get exactly what they want. We don't have to handle, I mean, if you go into conventional grocery stores, there's a lot of different people taking a piece of your price, right? And with e-commerce, we're able to you know, afford to do it because we're selling to you direct. So it makes a huge difference for us on the production side.
That's huge. Do you guys want to go into grocery stores?
Yeah, we do. Not with all the products. You know, on e-com, we have about 60 products. In grocery stores, we're doing about a dozen. So the products that have the margin structure to sustain that channel, if that makes sense. Because that channel, selling into grocery stores, there's distributors, there's fees, there's marketing stuff. Like, there's wastage. It's a more complex channel for us. So that's something we're expanding right now. And we're only doing it where we can do direct distribution. So right now we sell in Air One grocery stores. We're just about to add a large retailer here in Northern California. And that's going to be, it's really about direct distribution. So that when you're selling through a distributor, typically you have like, you know, a big chunk that you pay them as well. And then there's also various issues around like when they can tell you their order times, et cetera. And in our business, you know, that we're raising animals for processing, we have a pretty long time needed, you know, for when we get an order, right? So there's various aspects of the grocery industry that haven't worked as well for a farm-based business like Belcampo. But with the relationships that we have built, they've taken a long time to build, but they're better for us because they're allowing us to market in a way that supports our business model.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that time, just like you said with the animals, when we give something time to grow is what makes it so beautiful. So growing good relationships with those distributors helps you know that they're getting your products out in the best way possible. And again, all of the information you've given, you know, from regenerative farming to laying out that little masterclass there of the difference between grass-fed or conventionally raised, pasture-raised versus cage-free, was incredible. Is there anywhere that people could go, one, to learn more of the stuff that you were talking about today, or two, to order the products?
Just head to belcampo.com, our website. That's the home of all of our information. I write blogs regularly on that website that are available about things like, I just did one on suet, all about how to use suet, which is beef tallow, a form of beef tallow for cooking. It's also got great nutritional properties. I do lots of different blogs there. And then we're also just now starting to build out our YouTube content with a lot of the kind of stuff that I'm talking about here, of just, you know, sort of good information to know about your meat choices.
Amazing. You're truly bringing so much education in this space, and you're leading the way in showing what is possible for us to be able to have these kinds of products readily accessible to us. And I know, you know, you even allow people to go visit the farms, and you're allowing access to see such a beautiful process and show an example of what's possible. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for feeding our bellies and making us feel so yummy and so delicious all the time. So we appreciate it.
Well, I'm really glad to hear it. And it takes, you know, passionate advocates like you guys to win. So thank you for spreading the word. And, you know, it's like people deserve to have meat that they don't have complex mixed emotions about.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I really think people deserve that. Like, people deserve to have a product that they can be like, yeah, I feel great about every aspect of this. Mm. You know, that's something that we've been, you know, with meat, we've been asked to basically overcook it consistently.
Yeah.
To kill potential pathogens. We've been asked to just not ever request to know where it came from.
Yeah. Right?
Like, that's not within our rights to know where it came from. We've been asked to trust labels with words that we know kind of at some level are misleading, you know, natural and free range and cage free and things. It's like, this is, we've just, like, day after day, it's like we're kind of chipping away at our rights as consumers to a really, really important set of data that impacts our health about safety and wellness, right? And I just say, like, ask for more. You deserve it.
Yeah.
You know, you would never accept this treatment about, like, let's say, you know, your car, right? If you go to buy a car and they're like, yeah, I can't tell you where it came from. Can't tell you how much gas it's going to use. And if it breaks, we've got a great liability policy and we'll just pay you a lot of money if you or your children die.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, and that's kind of like the deal that we signed around our meat. And I'd say, forget that. Like, you don't know. You don't know. Sort of say, like, this idea that we're supposed to take something that we know very little about, we're supposed to, you know, basically handle it. It'd be as if we were buying a car and they're like, listen, don't go above 40 miles an hour. And if it crashes, we'll pay you liability. That's the attitude, right? Which is like, you can't do too much with this, you know, because it's not very safe, right? That's what we've been told about our meat. And it's, why would we ever accept that?
It's true. Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate you building back up the consumer, empowering the consumer to educate themselves on where this is all coming from and the quality behind the things that they put into their body. Thanks so much for doing your work to break down a lot of these barriers and structures and forge into this space. We really appreciate your time for the interview today.
Dig it. Thanks for all your support, guys.
And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.